From KQED Public Radio, this is Health Dialogues. It's hard enough keeping yourself and your family healthy. Imagine being responsible for the health of a whole county. Well, that's exactly what local public health departments do.
I plan for large communicable disease outbreaks or biological agent releases. So situations like pandemic flu or aerosolized anthrax, like the attacks in 2001.
But these days, public health departments are expanding their reach far beyond traditional boundaries. They're thinking about things like the health impact of poverty and racism, and how where you live can determine how long you live. Coming up, we'll hear why public health officials are working on economic development, even helping to plan neighborhoods and cities to make them healthier places to live. Public health in the 21st century. I'm Scott Schaefer, and this is Health Dialogues. When you hear the phrase public health, what comes to mind? Or maybe you don't give too much thought to public health at all. That is, until the public's health is threatened. Remember tainted spinach or SARS? What about the first time you heard about HIV/AIDS? Chances are a public health official was one of the first people you heard talking about it. This hour, we're looking at public health departments, how they affect our quality of life in some ways that might surprise you, and how that could change if public health budgets get the axe in Sacramento this year. So I got to thinking, what would a day, not just anyone's day, but my day, what would it be like if the public health department didn't exist? Where do I come in contact with the public health department without even really thinking about it? Like, take Tuesday nights. That's when I play water polo at a public pool in San Francisco.
Water polo is a little bit like soccer in the water. You've got two teams, two nets, a ball. Each team's trying to get the ball in the net. But instead of being on a field, they're in a swimming pool. Now, you might be wondering, what does water polo have to do with public health? And the answer is, polo doesn't really have anything to do with public health. It's all about the water.
In fact, you could spend a whole hour just talking about how public health departments protect our water. They check public swimming pools to make sure they have the balance of chlorine and other chemicals. They monitor tap water for purity and beaches for bacteria. They inspect wild oysters and mussels in our bays for toxins and warn us if they find them. They keep an eye on irrigation systems and wastewater disposal. And that's just water. When I get out of the pool, what's the first thing I do? After getting dressed, that is.
Can I get a super taco?
Super taco?
Yeah. No crema with carne asada.
Eat. What else? And trust me, you wouldn't want to eat in restaurants if the health department wasn't poking around now and then. Their inspectors make sure the soup is hot enough and the potato salad is cold enough, that the bathrooms are clean and the workers are washing their hands. In some counties, they even post a grade in the window to let you know if the restaurant is up to snuff. They're the folks who tell us to slim down our waistlines, slow down at crosswalks, start using condoms, stop using drugs, quit smoking, buckle up, get a flu shot, and get ready for the next earthquake. Come to think of it, public health departments are a little like parents, in the best sense, that is. Sometimes it feels like they're nagging us, but always with our best interests at heart. Or, in the case of this public health worker in Southern California, your dog's best interests.
I'm Karen Ehnert, and I work for the Los Angeles County Department of Public Health, and my job is to monitor animal health in the community. We do animal disease surveillance, whether it's West Nile virus or rabies. Sometimes we go out and we collect specimens like at dog parks. We run up to owners and say, we want your dog's poop so we can test it for parasites. So we're out there monitoring animal health since they're sentinels of human health in the community.
Those are just a few of the things public health departments are doing to keep us healthy, and it really just scratches the surface. Joining us now is someone who can help us fill in that picture a little bit, Dr. Tony Eiten. He's Director of Public Health for Alameda County. Dr. Eiten, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Let me begin by describe, if you would, what does it take to keep the people of your county, Alameda County, healthy?
Well, I should say that, you know, we consider ourselves to be in the business of preventing disease and keeping people healthy. And our citizens do a pretty good job of keeping themselves healthy if they have good information. And for those things where they have to participate in community types of interactions, if we make sure that the basic amenities that they're going to be using are clean and, you know, inspected. So we have, in some ways, an easy job. In other ways, a difficult job, because the communicable disease, or the infectious disease, that has really been the basis of public health for the past century or so.
So you say you're in the job of keeping people healthy, but how healthy are we? How good a job are you and other health departments doing?
Well, I think if you look at a measure of healthiness as life expectancy, it appears that we're doing pretty well on average. When you look at life expectancy over time in my county, Alameda County, it has been increasing. It's increased substantially over the past 40 or so years, and looks like it will continue to increase if we stay on this trajectory. However, there are some bright hotspots in our county where that is not the case, and the rates of increase in life expectancy have not nearly been as robust in African-American communities, particularly low-income African-American communities and other low-income communities of color.
And is it really concentrated in neighborhoods, or is it really spread throughout the city, those kinds of hotspots?
Well, the hotspots are really, we're finding that they're most easily described as concentrated in places, in neighborhoods, because our social policies have essentially confined certain populations to certain places. And those people in those places suffer from a whole host of environmental factors that lead to shortened life.
So give us some examples.
Well, for instance, if you take West Oakland or Bayview, Hunters Point, or parts of Richmond, you'll see the most obvious things that you'll see are poor air quality. You'll see diesel particulate emissions that are very high, 3-4 times higher than the background levels. Those things are known to cause asthma, chronic lung disease, heart disease. And they put people in the hospital more often, and they shorten people's lives. Those are the obvious things.
What are some of the less obvious things?
Well, some of the less obvious things that we're now having the ability to link to health outcomes include things like jobs and education. The ability to essentially compete in this economy requires not only a high school education, but a good high school education, plus some college education. And many kids in these communities that I've described don't really have a fair opportunity to achieve these things.
So what's the relationship between a decent job and a good education and your health?
Well, to put it as simply as I can, it's stress. And in essence, when you're cut off from opportunity, you feel much more stress in your day-to-day existence. And that stress has physiological consequences, including raising your blood pressure, raising hormones in your body that cause essentially damage and wear and tear on your blood vessels, on your heart, on your kidneys, and all your major organs.
But, how do you avoid stress? I mean, are we all exposed to stress in huge levels, especially if you live in an urban setting?
Yeah, I think that, this is where it sort of starts getting kind of interesting, because everybody has stress in their lives, but people who have resources to cope with the stress view the stress as more of a challenge. A stressing situation is a test. But if you don't have the resources, and you chronically don't have the resources, you basically start falling into this cycle of despair. And that cycle of despair is not a hopeful cycle, and it leads you to do things like smoke, for instance, or drink to dull some of the realities of your existence. And it also has, even without the smoking and the drinking, it has chronic detrimental effects on your pathophysiology or your body systems.
So what can a health department do about those things? It seems sort of beyond the purview of what you do.
Yeah, it may seem that way to a lot of people, but to us it's not, because we've looked at this challenge of eliminating health disparities and trying to essentially make the whole community healthier, and we're willing to go wherever we have to go to try to achieve these outcomes, which includes looking at the built environment, for instance. Are there parks? Are there places for people to exercise? Are there stores that sell healthy food? Is it safe on the streets for kids to play? Or are cars, essentially the priority item in those neighborhoods? So all of those things have health consequences, and there's no one silver bullet here. But I'll tell you, if you take your grandmother to some of these neighborhoods and you ask her, what would you do, Grandma, to make this place healthier? She'll give you some pretty good insights.
You're saying it's common sense?
It's common sense for the most part.
Yeah. So when you look at your county, Alameda County, what are some of the biggest health problems? You sort of alluded to some of them, but what are people dying of? What are people sick from?
Well, we at the top of the show, you started with a lot of what public health does, and that's focused on communicable or infectious disease. And the real challenge of public health has become chronic disease. It's the heart disease, it's the cancer, it's the strokes. These things are what are killing people in much higher numbers than infectious disease. And so the challenge there is really much broader than infectious disease. It's not just about getting rid of microbes or lowering human contact with microbes. It's in essence looking at the environment, the physical environment, the social environment, how people live their daily lives, how much time they're spending in cars, how much time they're spending sitting down in front of computers. do they really have the opportunity to exercise? Do they really have the opportunity to get healthy food? You know, what kind of marketing is going on around fast food messaging, alcohol, cigarettes? These kinds of things are the challenges for public health.
And when you look at those risk factors and those situational things, how do they compare with genetics, for example, in terms of the ultimate outcome you're going to have with somebody's health?
Well, genes play a role, not very much of a role, a much smaller role than one would think. Probably about 10 to 15% of the differences in health outcomes is controlled by genes. And we still don't know how well genes reflect the ethnic and racial differences. And on top of that, we don't really have a great handle on changing genetics. So it's sort of a little bit irrelevant. I mean, the things that we can change, that we create, the communities that we create, the policies that we create, we have full control over. So those things
are
preventable.
But do we really? I mean, if you think about, you have to deal with city planning and developers, and we're going to be talking more about that in the second part of this, but it seems to me that you, as a public health department, it might be easier or more cost-effective just to get people to quit smoking, to do some of the more traditional things, you know, make sure the restaurants are clean, make sure that people are using a condom, you know, the kinds of things that will cut down on diseases we know how to prevent.
Yeah, and it's not an either-or. We're still going to be getting people to stop smoking, and we've done a really good job of that in California, and it's paid dividends. We're still going to be encouraging people to engage in behaviors that are health protective to them. But what we found is, if you look over time, that approach doesn't work in and of itself. When people don't have a realistic opportunity to engage in the behaviors that we're encouraging, they're not going to do them. So we have to be smarter. And what we need to do is work across disciplines. I mean, there's nothing special about public health. The transportation world, the land use world, the education world, they're facing some of these same disparities, these same problems, and they're yearning for opportunities to work with us. That's what we find when we start talking to them about the implications of their work on our work. So we're much smarter than we allow ourselves to be.
You can do two things at once.
Yeah.
Yeah. So if you're saying chronic diseases, diabetes, cancer, heart disease, hypertension, those sorts of things, if those are the real problem issues that affect lots of people and cost lots of money, to what extent are you getting help from, say, the state or the federal government to deal with those kinds of problems?
Well, I think that the focused work in these areas is still in its infancy. I think we're still learning what kinds of interventions make sense, particularly as these interventions span multiple disciplines. You know, to control communicable disease, you can just set out essentially some practices that when somebody's infected, there are certain things they can do, certain things they can't do. We isolate them, we treat them. But when the environment is contributing to obesity, for instance, we can't just order a city to, you know, create parks. We can't force a school district to, you know, leave their gyms and their recreational fields open in the evenings for communities to be able to use them. We can't impose after-school programming on communities. So we have to work with people whose interests are aligned with our interests in trying to achieve these things.
Your county recently released a report called Life and Death from Unnatural Causes. It was actually part of a PBS series that's airing nationwide. What, in your view, is an unnatural cause of death?
Well, that's a great question. One of the things that we have been struggling with is this notion that death and disease are not randomly distributed, and that the causes that one would think, smoking, drinking, the things that people do to themselves, have a relatively small role in the ultimate distribution of disease. And so the unnatural things that we see are essentially an opportunity structure in this country in the Bay Area that limits systematically people's access to health protective resources, such as parks and recreation, access to healthy foods, keeping them away from unhealthy foods, and then things like opportunities in employment, living wage, housing, transportation, education. All of those things have health implications, and when you add them all up, you start to see how they can distribute themselves along geographic lines that are consistent with how we have distributed these resources.
And what does a public health department do? How do you work with the various cities in Alameda County or the county itself to make changes there?
Well, the good news is that there are a lot of people who are really interested in doing this work. People are very, very eager to see how, for instance, land use design, smart growth, can have health implications. It bolsters their argument in front of their city boards and commissions to say, look, this is not just about aesthetics. This also has health implications. And here's the public health department to show you how this affects the obesity rates and chronic disease rates. So they're very eager to work with us. What we haven't had really is enough time and opportunity to develop a practice that is evidence-based, that shows that if you do these things, you will get these benefits or these dividends. And that's what we're working on now. So primarily, we're still in the mode of demonstrating the linkages between these disciplines that are considered to be far afield from health with health outcomes and important health outcomes like death and chronic disease.
You know, sometimes health issues are kind of partisan. You know, people come down, I mean, an obvious example is abortion. But to what extent are the things you're describing, is there a partisan divide along, you know, I assume Republican, Democrat, or it could be urban, rural, suburban? I mean, does it break down that way?
Well, one of the things that we stumble up against frequently is this notion of individual responsibility versus sort of societal responsibility. And we don't like to pose those as either or, as we think that individual responsibility is really critical. It's just not enough, particularly when you're talking about kids and you're talking about factors that are clearly outside of the control of individuals, like the design of their communities, the quality of their schools, the quality of education and employment that they have access to. All of those things are clearly not within the direct control of individuals, particularly poor individuals who are struggling to make ends meet. So we think individual responsibility is important, and we think that, you know, people need to be reminded that smoking is bad for you and drinking is bad for you. But we also need to give people hope and opportunity so that they can make those choices and see a future for themselves by making those good choices.
Are there some examples you can think of, either in Alameda County or elsewhere, where these kinds of principles have been put into place and you can point to something as a real success and use it to encourage funding for other kinds of similar efforts?
Yeah, we've done something quite creative in Alameda County called Youth Uprising, this notion of focusing on youth development and recognizing that if you give kids sort of a stake in their future, they will make the right investment. So Youth Uprising is really, it's a place-based initiative. We've sort of rehabbed an old Safeway warehouse and created this educational, vocational, youth development environment for low-income kids in East Oakland. And they learn how to do what you do, for instance, to, you know, host a radio show or to do some of the production work that, you know, goes into doing radio or other media. They learn how to do music. They learn how to...
Isn't that what the schools are supposed to be doing?
Well, I don't like to get into this blaming thing, you know, school has to do this, community does that. I think that what's obvious is that when you look at youth developmental measures, that kids are not getting the kind of supports that they need. They're not getting the meaningful opportunities for civic engagement. They're not getting high expectations in both education and career, and they're lacking meaningful relationships with adults. So we need to create that no matter where the actual setting is. If it's not in the schools, let's do it in the community. If it's not in the community, let's do it in the schools. Let's do it wherever we can.
So play it out a little bit. These kids are learning these things, music, art, computers, how to do a radio show. How does that then, where does that go? Where does that take you that they wouldn't go if a place like Youth Uprising didn't exist?
Yeah. Again, if you took your grandmother out to East Oakland and had her walk around, and the first thing she'd say is that these kids have nothing to do. They're idle. They're bored. Nobody's investing in them. You can see it in their eyes. So your grandmother would create a youth uprising, essentially an after-school program for kids to engage their talents. And when kids, and this doesn't take a lot of rocket science, when kids see that somebody values them, sees them as being worthwhile, they flourish. And when they flourish, they take better care of themselves. They're less likely to get in fights, less likely to join gangs, less likely to smoke, less likely to drink, less likely to do all those individual behaviors that we lecture them about all the time. So it's about investing in their future, making them recognize that we see them as valuable. That makes all the difference. Again, your grandmother, my grandmother, are probably better public health planners than most of the public health planners we have now.
Now, given the budget environment that we're in, we're going to be hearing from somebody from the State Department of Public Health shortly. But, you know, you're not flush with a lot of money. So when there's tight times and budgets get cut, what falls through the cracks? What do you not do that you would like to be doing?
Yeah, well, this is where I get into trouble with my colleagues, because I don't think it's about money. I think it's about how we do our work. Like I said, I think we're smarter than we demonstrate. I have a $110 million budget every year to spend on public health in Alameda County, and it's locked into programs that have dictates associated with them, and outcomes. And those outcomes tend not to be as meaningful an outcome as I think we ought to be focusing on.
So, give an example.
Oh, how many brochures did you hand out at this health fair? You know, how many, you know, kids, you know, learn that smoking is bad for you on this day at this event? And I think we've sort of exhausted sort of the limits of some of this traditional health education where the public health department hectors people into trying to behave better. So I think we can take the existing money that we have, and not just in public health, but, you know, looking at education budgets, land use, transportation, and set some common goals, some common outcomes that work across all of these disciplines, and then force us to work together to achieve those goals. This doesn't require more money. It requires spending the enormous amount of money that we already spend smarter.
So what's the resistance to that?
Well, we're not structured to do that right now. There isn't a lot of incentive to do that. Right now we operate in silos. The federal government, you know, because somebody's great uncle, you know, had some disease, they set up a program for that disease. And then the people, and these are good people, these are not, you know, silly people, but they're operating in an environment where you have to protect your particular interest. And so we have these silos that get created that flow from the federal government to the state government to the local. And they say, we don't care what you do as long as it's about prostate cancer and you know, treating people or preventing prostate cancer. And they don't say, you know, focus on the social determinants of health that may lead to prostate cancer. They say, focus on prostate cancer. So what you end up doing is handing out brochures about prostate cancer and getting an exam, which is a good idea. But it's not ultimately going to get to the root causes of the differential distribution of prostate cancer in society.
At the same time, you also have an aging population, and so I guess you think of Alzheimer's as a chronic disease.
Sure.
Yeah. You're going to have more incidences of those kinds of diseases. Is there a tension there between dealing with these other kind of health inequities?
Absolutely not. There really isn't, because when you think of something like land use and urban design, we have this maxim that if you design for seniors, you design for everybody. So you create places that are more walkable, more usable, have access to amenities. That's good for everybody's health. More people will walk. More people will use the roads. They'll use the bikeways. And seniors will feel safer and more comfortable. So we actually have an opportunity here with the aging of the population, the chronic disease, burgeoning chronic disease epidemic in this country, to actually do some really smart design that has multiple benefits to multiple populations.
Coming back to this idea of budget cuts, you seem fairly sanguine about it. Do you get flack from your other county health officers who say, hey, you know, you're screwing it up here. We have to put together a united front and prevent these cuts.
Yeah, you know, I'm not pro-cuts. Don't get me wrong. All I'm arguing is that, you know, we don't give up on trying to do innovative things because the budget environment is tight. And I think before, you know, and I say this about education or any other discipline that is complaining about cuts, yeah, sure, we need more money, but more money for what? And can we justify what we're doing based on the root causes of what we're seeing? Because a lot of what we do is focusing on essentially the consequences or the symptoms of not attending to the root causes. And if we work together, I think we could actually save money. It's not efficient to essentially have the, you know, the education worker knocking on the door, then the TB worker knocks on the door, and then it's the, you know, the WIC worker. It's not efficient to operate that way. You've got to look at families in communities and understand what are the stressors, what are the forces that are creating these kinds of outcomes, and work on those stressors and those forces together.
When we talk about things like healthcare reform, which seems to occupy a lot of our time, and we're getting short on time, but are we missing the point, really? Because that seems to focus on access to healthcare. You're saying that maybe that doesn't matter quite so much, because by the time you have access to healthcare, you're probably sick already.
Yeah, don't get me wrong. Access to healthcare is really important. I mean, it's important both as a social benefit. It's also important as a straight health benefit. And, you know, one of the things that Schwarzenegger has done well is he introduced this concept of prevention and community redesign into his healthcare proposal, which we strongly supported as public health officials around the state. So it's not an either or. Healthcare is important, but it's not the answer. It's not sufficient to solve the problems that we're challenged with.
That's Dr. Tony Eitan. He's Director of Public Health for Alameda County. Thanks so much for being with us.
It's a pleasure, as always.
And coming up, we're going to talk a little bit more about those sidewalks and parks, what they have to do with public health, and how we might be able to have more of them in some of our urban settings, what that might cost, what the trade-offs are. You're listening to Health Dialogues.
My name is Nancy LaPlace. I'm a public health nurse and case manager for the Babies First Program, Fresno County's Department of Public Health. My program is an in-home visitation program for high-risk pregnant women. I assist my clients in obtaining a prenatal provider if they don't have one and encourage these women to receive continuous prenatal care throughout their pregnancy. I teach good nutrition, the importance of taking their prenatal vitamins, the elimination of any use of drugs, alcohol, and tobacco during their pregnancy so that they have a healthy baby.
Yet another way public health departments work to keep us healthy, and that's our topic this hour on Health Dialogues. I'm Scott Schaefer. A few minutes ago, we were talking about chronic diseases and how where we live and how we live can affect our health. And at the rate we're going in California, it may not be long until the day when more people have diabetes or heart disease than don't. Reversing that trend, say public health officials, will take nothing less than a grand reordering of the world we inhabit. Changes to where we live, how we eat, how we get to our jobs and schools. Sarah Varney reports on a new housing development in the city of Chino, 50 miles east of Los Angeles, that may be a model for that new, healthier world.
Angelica Lusano is sitting on a swing in a brand new public park in Chino, watching her daughter and nephew bounce across a playground bridge. She moved here to The Preserve, Chino's newest development, last year with her husband and three children. Where Lusano used to live, she rarely let her children play outside. The air was heavy with smog, there were few parks, and the streets often turned into a battleground between local gangs.
Now while we're living here, I don't worry about it. It's everything like safe. That's why I feel. I don't feel any worriness for my kids. They could go anywhere around here, and sometimes when they're riding a bike, well, even though it gets dark, I don't have to worry about that because I know when they are, they're not home, they're in the park.
Next to the park is a new K-8 school with a gymnasium that neighbors can use after school hours and gardens where school kids can learn about how their food is grown. All of this is just a short walk from Lusano's home. On weekend mornings, she and her husband sip coffee on their front porch and say hello to strolling families. These seem like common sense ideas. Putting schools and parks in the middle of neighborhoods, building streets that invite walking, and homes that create social ties and make neighborhoods safer. But it also may be that these smart growth principles, as land use planners call them, are the most cost-effective way of preventing obesity.
It has the potential capacity to affect a lot of people, much more than separate programs, much more than separate interventions.
Mary Ann Pence is a professor at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California and directs USC's Institute for Prevention Research. Pence received what public health researchers believe is the first grant awarded by the National Institutes of Health to evaluate whether a community based entirely on smart growth principles reduces a family's risk for obesity.
If you think of an example years ago about introducing fluoride into water or inoculations for everyone, that's a large-scale effort that's had a huge impact on people, on whole populations. And in a similar way, looking at how you build out and make choices during the planning process is an exciting way to affect and shift the health of an entire population.
Over the next 4 years, Pence will track 300 families that live in the preserve, a mix of moderate-income homeowners to low-income renters, and compare their physical activity and overall health to families that live nearby. The groups will be matched for age, race and ethnicity, education, income, and health status. Families will wear credit card size activity monitors and global positioning units that will tell Pence when, where, and how the families are exercising. She'll take their weight, height, and waist measurement and survey for asthma, diabetes, and heart conditions. The hypothesis is those living in the preserve will become healthier than those stuck in nearby neighborhoods that were built more for cars than for people. Pence's preliminary research has already turned up what could be good news. The brand new preserve doesn't have any fast food outlets yet. Without the lure of the Golden Arches right around the corner, families say they're eating healthier meals at home. But at this point, it's worth considering how the world of the preserve meshes with the world in the rest of Chino. The city is a leader in the movement to bring public health into its decisions about land use, education, and transportation. The school district pulled soft drinks long before state law required it to do so. But on Chino's boulevards, says the city's mayor, Dennis Yates, fast food joints flourish like they do everywhere else in America.
Our largest eatery in sales in the whole city of Chino, believe it or not, and we have some nice restaurants, is McDonald's on Central Avenue. And you know what number two is in our city? In-N-Out Burger. That's
it. The tax dollars from McDonald's and the rest are good for this city. But since fast food is cast as a villain in our national obesity epidemic, shouldn't the city be concerned about it?
But I thought one of the ideas with having a healthy element in your general plan was to
absolutely
say, yes, that's great, they make a lot of money, but it's not consistent with this.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I'll go back to this. This isn't communist China.
And families in the preserve don't live in a bubble. Like many across the state, parents here are harried by the day-to-day realities of life.
Someone working in L.A. or Orange County, you know, it takes them an hour and a half to get home by the time they pick up the kids from the babysitters or whatever program they're in. And they get home at 6 or 6:30 at night, and they're exhausted. They're stressed out from driving the freeways. And it's just easier to stop by a fast food joint, give the kids some French fries and a cheeseburger and a Coke, and here, eat this and go to bed.
What's clear is even with the preserve's commitment to creating a healthier way to live for its residents, the bigger health issues we face can't be solved one subdivision at a time. For Health Dialogues, I'm Sarah Varney.
The city of Chino is providing one model of how to plan and build communities that are healthier for people living in them. But San Bernardino County isn't the only place thinking about the built environment. Joining me now, someone who thinks along those lines for San Francisco County, Dr. Rajiv Bhatia, Director of Occupational and Environmental Health for San Francisco's Department of Public Health. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
Well, we just heard what's going on down in Chino. Give us a little critique, if you would. What is that relationship between growth and so-called smart growth and health?
Well, I think the premise underneath trying to plan for healthy places is that we know the environment shapes our health. And you talked about a little this with Dr. Eitan a bit ago. I think what's important, though, is that smart growth can do quite a bit. But I think that smart growth could benefit from having an additional health lens. Smart growth has focused on bringing people close, bringing people and their uses closer together, which increases physical activity. But we have to also be cautious that we're not putting housing near environmental pollution, near industrial sources. So any mixed use isn't okay. Certain mixed uses, certain industrial uses may not be appropriate for residential uses. Probably more important than that is we have to make sure that we're making our smart growth communities inclusive. If we don't do that, we're going to be perpetuating the health disparities. We're going to be providing healthier neighborhoods for some, but not for others.
So meaning like having more mixed income housing, for example?
More mixed income housing. There's a case in the Central Valley right now that I think is quite fascinating, where developers of a single family neighborhood are coming up against a lot of opposition because they're trying to make some of that single family housing rental. And that's the kind of, you know, I think it's got to be healthy for all, not just healthy for some.
Well, and how do you convince someone that wants to have an upscale neighborhood that they should be more inclusive? What's in it for them, just to be really, you know, blunt and selfish about it?
Well, I think you can look at it from the blunt and selfish perspective. Their grandkids may not have the same opportunities. So I think if they're thinking a few generations down the line, I think they need to be thinking about, from a self-interest, about creating an equitable society for all, and that means sharing. I think from this isn't a decision just to be made by the property owners or the people who are living there. There's a broader social interest in having integrated, healthy communities. We all suffer. We spend $6,000 per year per person for healthcare services. A cost containment strategy is to make all of us healthier. So there's a big, broad social interest in doing this.
So give us a sense of when you go into a neighborhood in San Francisco and pick one, what kind of an assessment do you do as to some of the issues that are there that are having a negative impact on people? What are you looking for?
Well, I need to back up. I mean, I've worked with the San Francisco Health Department for about 10 years. When we started this work, it was largely focused in Bayview Hunters Point, where the focus of community concerns were toxic hazards like the shipyard and the power plant. But working with those communities, we realized, and they realized, there was the lack of access to healthy food, there was the lack of parks, there was the safety. And then we saw these issues not only in Bayview, but the exact same place and health conditions in other neighborhoods, like South of Market. In 2004, working with the planning department and about 20 neighborhood groups, community groups, we developed something called the Healthy Development Measurement Tool. This tool collected data on 80 to 90 different conditions of neighborhood health, from parks to schools, to transit access, to the quality of housing, to the quality of jobs, and it provides a really robust assessment tool to look at everything that's important to health. The second part of the tool helps planners design plans and project. It says for every one of these goals and every one of these issues, it sets a development target. What does a healthy plan look like? What does a healthy project look like?
So give us an example of a target that you put in place in a neighborhood in San Francisco that you met and has made a difference or will make a difference once it's fully implemented.
I can give you a couple. So an example of a target is every residence should be within a quarter mile of a park, that the way to get to that park should be a safe walking a walking path. We have goals for setting no increases in pedestrian injuries in that area and how you do that by design. One of those targets that I think has been more fully implemented is this issue around we have very limited space in San Francisco. We know that we need to build housing near some busy roadways. Those roadways have higher levels of air pollution. So we help the planning department figure out how you analyze that air pollution. But more importantly, we figured out how you might prevent new residents from suffering air pollution by hazards through ventilation systems. And then we've integrated that into the planning process. So that review becomes a regular part of the planning process.
And what about things like jobs and economic development? Are you working on those issues as well as part of a public health agenda?
They're part of our agenda. I couldn't say that we're directly working on those through planning. We have them as criteria in our tool. We have design strategies that are part of the menu of what planners can do. We are working on those issues, the economic agenda, in other ways. In 1999, San Francisco, the health department worked with those who were supporting a living wage in San Francisco by providing a health analysis of that living wage. In 1996, we provided a health analysis of a paid sick days policy. So the land use and planning sector isn't necessarily the place you work on economic issues. So you have to work in different sectors.
So it's a broad array of social policies, really.
Right, and a broad array of sectors.
Yeah.
The Parks Department it's not just the Planning Department, it's the Parks Department, the transportation agencies that are our partners in this work.
That's Dr. Rajiv Bhatia. He's Director of Occupational and Environmental Health in San Francisco's Department of Public Health. Let's go up towards Sacramento now. Dr. Bonnie Sorensen is Chief Deputy Director of Policy and Programs for the California Department of Public Health. Dr. Sorensen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to this conversation that's been looking at local issues. How do you see things differently from your perch in Sacramento?
I think we see things quite similarly to Dr. Bhatia as well as Dr. Eitan, but on a more grand scale, a more large scale. But it's really amazing how similarly we're all thinking.
So is the State Department of Health helping counties do the kinds of things that they were talking about?
We certainly are on their same page and aligned with their thinking and doing the most that we can to support them, learning ourselves, you know, what are the priorities for the locals. I think generally the locals tend to be ahead of state departments of public health, not only in California, but really across the nation. The state tends to be restricted more by federal funding, whereas the locals have a great deal of local funding as well. So, you know, really the State Department of Public Health, its purpose is really to support the locals.
Now, Alameda County and San Francisco County, of course, are urban places, but California has 56 other counties. Many of them are rural. How do the public health issues and challenges in those places differ?
Well, they certainly differ. We're talking about healthcare reform. Access to health services is different in the rural communities compared to the urban. Also, access to the amenities that you spoke to about in Chino, parks and sidewalks, lighted streets tend to be more of a challenge in the rural community compared to urban.
And are there fewer resources to deal with those questions?
I think there are fewer resources per person, but obviously, you know, the assets and challenges are different per person as well.
And you, as I mentioned earlier, the state is facing a very serious budget challenge. The governor is talking about a 10% across-the-board cut. How is that going to affect the Department of Public Health and then trickle down to the counties?
Well, the Department of Public Health really has looked at its programs all across the department and took those budget reductions kind of generally across the department, with the goal being to preserve the essential public health functions in each of our programs. So as we reduce our budget at the state, a proportional reduction will be felt at the local level.
Is it an across-the-board cut, is that really the best way to cut a budget? I mean, it seems to me you ought to really, it doesn't allow you to really set priorities if everyone's getting whacked at the same level.
Well, I think as Dr. Eitan mentioned, it's not all about money. It's more about priorities. It's more about synergizing. Really, it's an opportunity for us at the state level as well as the local level to understand how can we leverage the limited resources all of us have to better our communities and state.
Dr. Badia, what, from your perspective at the county level, what would you like the state to be doing more of, or less of for that matter, to help you accomplish the kinds of things that you were talking about?
Well, I think there are two things. One has to do with supporting the city's experimentation and innovative efforts. And the second is to take to do health impact assessments of state level policy. Let me go to the second one first. A lot of policy affects health, I think, as we've learned. We have policies at the state level like menu labeling and paid sick days that could have huge benefits to health and cut healthcare costs. The state could be doing the research on those policies and helping show the health rationale for some of the policies or health harms of policies, so we can be making better state-level decisions. These are health impact assessment is a tool that's being used in other countries for about 20 years, and the U.S. needs to be using it. At the local level, as an example of supporting innovation, there's a bill, AB 1472, the Healthy Places Act. This bill would provide guidance and tools to health departments locally to do health impact assessments working with communities. Counties like San Francisco, we're privileged. We have a lot of resources. We have a very progressive environment to work in. Not all the counties, rural counties, have that. So disseminating the tools that are being created in innovative centers of practice is a really important role for the state, and AB 1472 would help do that.
Dr. Sorensen, do you have any sense of where the governor is on that bill?
No, I really couldn't speak to that.
I mean, is the governor supportive of doing those kinds of measurements and assessments and research at the county level? Because, you know, he is a Republican, and many in the Republican Party, I think, see some of these policies as being sort of the nanny state. Is that an issue that you feel that you have to deal with working at the state level?
Well, I think I agree with Dr. Bhatia about the innovation and creativity at the local level. That's where the rubber hits the road, so to speak, and the state role would be to really display and showcase those best practices as well as leverage the resources we have at the state level. Dr. Bhatia mentioned research. We have great universities in California, and working together with those state universities to really guide that research based out of the creativity and innovation at the local level. Really is a great opportunity for the state as well as California.
Dr. Buddy.
I think, you know, there's an interest. Washington State, the State Department of Health, was recently charged through legislation to do a health impact assessment of building a new bridge, a new highway bridge. And I think that's going to really show a lot of the utility of this work and broaden the idea of what a State Department of Health can do. So there's other state bills like AB 1472 across the country, and I think the role of states, and they definitely need the resources and support to do this, but we'll show that.
Dr. Sorensen, are there things about California, its population, its economy, whatever it might be, that present a different set of challenges for public health departments than, say, you know, Iowa or Massachusetts or Florida?
Well, certainly the first thing that comes to mind is the diversity of the population in California is unlike any other state in the nation. In addition, the international appeal of California with our many ports and oceans and airports, we are a global destination. So there are many challenges from an infectious disease perspective about that. But the diversity of the population leads to many of the issues that Dr. Eitan mentioned. How do we address health disparities? How do we address social inequities in our state?
And does the state see that as its role to help reduce those inequities?
Absolutely. We are really guiding our strategic planning in that direction, as are the locals.
Give an example of one way that, that's happening at the state level.
Well, the new Department of Health, Public Health in California, has a strategic plan, and of the five goals, one of those goals is addressing health disparities and quality of life. So we'll be working on multiple objectives related to that goal. We see health disparities, particularly in such a diverse state, as one of the highest priorities for the department.
And as we were saying earlier, chronic disease is such a huge problem, not just in California, but certainly here as well as most states. Diabetes, health implications of obesity, heart disease, and so on. The state, what role does it see in those diseases in prevention in particular? And I would think even at the school level where, you know, before you can get people before they develop these illnesses.
Right. I think that the chronic disease is really the challenge for the future for the entire state. We see obesity as an epidemic at the state level, and we have a coordinating office about obesity prevention. And our role really at the state level is to partner with all of our state partners as well as local partners to try to address that.
Dr. Badia, what about you locally in terms of those kinds of chronic diseases? Are you working with, for example, with the schools?
I'm not working with the schools directly except on food issues. And, for example, the city is supporting salad bars in the schools, again, with the idea of healthy environments and making healthy choices. I want to go back to you. You mentioned what's the state doing on inequity. I want to not underestimate how difficult really dealing with health inequities are. I mean, at the root, health inequities are a result of fundamental social inequities, inequities in resources. So you can tamper around the edges, but really confronting health inequities is really changing the balance of resources that people have, redistributing resources. That's not an easy thing to do. It means, as you said, if people don't want to live in neighborhoods with poor people? How do you change that fundamental social consciousness that's driving segregation, that helped create our suburbs, that helped create a number of the problems that we are? It needs clear political leadership as much as global warming or any other problem like that does.
Are there other counties that you are aware of that are sort of models? Of course, Alameda County is doing a lot.
But Alameda County, there's a set of counties and work that's happening nationally. Louisville, Kentucky is an example. The National Association of City and County Health Officials has a social justice and health working group that is largely representative of some of the leaders at the local level across the country, and they're supporting each other in figuring out how to do this.
And when you talk about leadership at the state level, like what would make a difference? What could the governor do? What could the speaker of the assembly do, and so on?
Well, I haven't heard any of these people actually talk about health disparities, define health disparities, define what the social determinants and environmental determinants of health disparities are. So establishing health disparities and health inequities as a state priority would be a start. Having the State Department of Health do an analysis of inequities in this health inequities in the state and what their causes are. In 2001, the state of Minnesota did this. So that's a working model for that, which can bring about a lot of interest.
And there are things that we've done here in San Francisco, like you mentioned, the living wage ordinance, raising the minimum wage. What other kinds of policies could you envision at a state level that would make a big difference?
I think at the state level, there could be requirements around planning. The state, even though a lot of planning happens at the local level, there could be some minimum criteria for parks, for schools. Policies around supporting resources for supermarkets in low-income areas. These ideas are really captured in redevelopment law. They're unfortunately not fully implemented. even though they are clear directions. So really paying attention to this at the state level and implementing the fundamental sort of goals and visions of the redevelopment law that we've had on the books for
a long time. And Dr. Sorensen, any initiatives planned at the state level along those lines?
Yeah, we have a number of groups that are meeting together at the local level. Obviously, folks across different sectors meet on a regular basis, and at the state level, we're trying to do the same. We have a blueprint group that meets together. It's sponsored by the Department of Transportation, but includes Parks and Recreation and the planning groups as well as the health groups. And I think at the state level, these other agencies are realizing that public health really is the answer to the question, so what? We have a built environment. The answer is it's about health. As Dr. Eitan mentioned, many of these community groups at the local level as well as at the state level are realizing the value of looking at health as the reason for improving our environments, and the environmental changes, hopefully will be followed by the lack or lessening of these social inequities.
Dr. Bhatia, last word from you. Anything you'd like to see happen? What would make the biggest difference in the short term?
I think these aren't technological problems. If we want to create healthy, equitable societies, we know how to do it. We need political leadership. We need our political leaders to say, yeah, it's going to take, it's sharing is a value we learned in third grade, and that we're not doing it right now, and we must do it.
And it gets tougher during tough economy too. People are in a less sharing, equitable mood.
I think I'm with Tony. We would have been able to do this without any resources.
All right. Dr. Thanks. Rajiv Bhatia, thank you so much. And also Dr. Bonnie Sorensen from the State Department of Public Health. And at the top of the hour, in the first half hour, thanks also to Dr. Tony Eitan, Director of Public Health for Alameda County. If you missed any part of this discussion or if you want to listen to past programs, you can go to our website. It's healthdialogues.org. Health Dialogues is a production of the California Report and KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. We had production assistance from John Myers. Eric Gillespie is the outreach manager. Our researcher is Erica Kelly. The producer is Polly Stryker. And our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report's Health Dialogue series are provided by the California Endowment for coverage of healthcare in California and the members of KQED Public Radio.